We're working actively to transition a full service hotel in downtown LA from one manager to another. This is a 200 room property.
Episode 24 of the Deal Ranch podcast. Roman Padan, founder and CEO of Casa with a K. Thanks for having me here in your apartment in Brooklyn. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we got to catch up a little bit, and obviously this came, we had Jonathan Langer on from Fireside Investments, who we can talk about later maybe as an investor of your company. But on episode 16, I was digging through, obviously you're one of the portfolio companies and you guys have a great story and an extremely a competitive brand and disruptive brand to the hospitality and long-term living market. So I'll kick it over to you for an intro on yourself briefly, and then an overview of Casa, if that works for you.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been excited to work with Jonathan. He's on our board. Obviously, was on the board of Westin and Hilton in the past, and we're excited to have him invested in the business. So I started Casa about almost 8 years ago now, and we are increasingly regarded as the industry standard for improving the profitability of hospitality and hospitality adjacent properties. And we primarily do that by lowering the cost structure of operating hospitality properties. We either eliminate unnecessary elements of the operation to lower the cost structure, automate systems, services, or technology, or centralize them. So we eliminate the front desk at all of our properties. People check in and go straight to their room using their mobile device as their guide. We automate finance and accounting, and we centralize things like revenue management, accounting and finance as well, and sales, which allows for a higher margin and a lower fixed cost at the property. So we improve the profitability of properties primarily by lowering the cost structure. But we also improve revenue by widening distribution, improving revenue management, and delivering a better experience, so better review scores to guests. That's sort of the engine that we built, the engine that improves the profitability of hospitality properties. We then deploy that engine into three different form factors, physical form factors. Think of it as like our sedan, our SUV, our crossover. We operate in multifamily properties, in hotels, and in clustered investor-owned single-family homes, in apartments where we take one floor to two or three floors to a full apartment building, and we operate it as a furnished rental, operate it any length of stay. In hotels, we operate the entire building and make it more profitable as a powered by Casa property versus what it was before. And in investor-owned furnished single-family homes that are clustered together, we operate them as furnished rentals, and again, make them more profitable with us versus if they were operated as a long-term lease or in another modality. We're in about 75 properties nationwide today, and we're trusted by some of the largest and most discerning real estate owners. So we're proud partners with Starwood Capital, with TPG, with KKR, with Greystar, with Cortland, with Berkshire, with Morgan Stanley's real estate fund, and Amley Residential specifically within it, and quite a few others. We have 40 plus partners across the U.S. And finally, we, unlike many others in the space who used leases to grow their business, we focused on growing our business using management agreements. It's been more deliberate growth path, but we think the right path for a business of this kind. So businesses like Sonder, WeWork, Regus, have all done master leases. Businesses like Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt have obviously grown through a more aligned management agreement structure, and that's the one we've focused on.
I love it. It's a great intro. And obviously, if no one's been to the website, casa.com, and the end of I think you covered well there, the, you know, how you guys are obviously a good partner to operators or asset owners, but in the end, you're providing this quality product, which is a more reliable stay, obviously, compared to other platforms, because you guys do quite a bit of monitoring in each room and background checks for each of the guests, too. So I want to talk about that. But your lead up to CASA, I think, is also very important and interesting to me in that you started another cool company, it seemed like, in college. But I'll let you, if you want to give your background story, it seems like you came from Ukraine and then to Wharton. If you want to talk about your personal journey, and then we can kind of talk about the CASA journey.
You do your research. So I was born in Ukraine, it's true, and feel fortunate that really my parents took a risk to come to the U.S. I try to say that to myself every morning because there are some things that are linear in progression where you get better every day, and then and it leads to a great outcome. And then there's some things that are step function or just fundamental changes that either you control or you don't control. And I'm very grateful for the fact that we moved when I was two to the U.S. and it wasn't a decision that I controlled. And so I feel, you know, but it is one that probably has had more influence over what I've had the opportunity to do and build. And so feel very grateful to those opportunities and a responsibility to honor that risk that that my parents and many other immigrants into the United States families have made. I grew up in a town in north of Boston. Was fortunate to be able to go to Penn, where I studied two great loves that I, when I studied them, thought were star-crossed and not going to intersect. I always loved technology. I always loved real estate. I studied real estate in the Wharton School. I studied computer science and engineering school at Penn. And really realized I needed to pick a lane because there wasn't such a thing as prop tech. There wasn't such a thing as technology intersecting with real estate. Zillow was in its infancy at that time. That was all that prop tech really was. You're right. I started a business that was entirely technology oriented.
This is Bookly.
This is Bookly. Yeah. It was more like all ideas, entrepreneurial ideas that I think are more likely to end up being reasonably good ones. It started with my personal problem, which was really expensive textbooks at schools. And I did some research and found that something like a sixth, for many students who are going to public universities, they're spending at the time, so I haven't refreshed in 2006, 2010, through 2010, something like $1,500 a year on school books. At that time, they're spending $7,000 a year in total. Wow. On their education. And so a huge percentage of their spend was going to overly expensive books that they were purchasing at the bookstore. And Bookly was a simple idea to lower prices for students while making sure they were getting the right materials for their education. We basically functioned like kayak.com, but for textbooks. So we'd find not just the book at the bookstore, but also looked at 20 different booksellers online, used, rental, new. And on average, we were saving over 50% for students, both on their purchase, but we'd also help them sell the book on the back end.
Oh, no way.
And we were asset light, just like CASA is, taking a cut of every transaction. We ended up selling something like $15 million worth of textbooks and took a small cut. We're proud to have saved students a similar amount of money in terms of what they would have spent otherwise. It was exciting to build, but I will admit, I was not very passionate about books outside of the problem that,
sure.
that it was solving for me.
Just out of curiosity, how did you build the platform? Because obviously you're kind of creating this common space, which is the product, right? This platform that compares all the different websites. Like how did that come to be?
Yeah. So I studied computer science, so I have that background. This was part of initially the seed for this idea came from working on a school class, and then it grew beyond that. I partnered with my brother on building the business.
Oh, really cool.
Yeah, so my brother, I'm a dilettante in computer engineering. He is a master, literally. He has a master's in computer science. He works currently at Amazon and automates their warehouses. But at the time, we were collaborating to build the technology and then create the agreements with booksellers and market it to students. I spent more of my time on the growing the number of students that knew about us portion of the business and creating the relationship with the booksellers. My brother spent more of the time on the engineering side, but we kind of helped each other in both areas.
That's a good partnership there. So after school, how do you end up at Walton Street Capital? What was the overview of the role? And then we can kind of keep rolling through.
Yeah. So I had to choose technology or real estate. I had this amazing summer internship, which I've not talked about in quite some time. In 2009, I was lucky to have any kind of internship. It was in quantitative CMBS trading at Citigroup. That's right. And it was exciting because we're kind of in the eye of the storm, being in the CMBS desk in 2009, and it allowed me to really use all the things I was interested in, whether it was technology. We were building models, we're coding models that were predicting default rates of CMBS securities, or real estate. Obviously, all of these were backed by buildings. And what I realized in that internship was I was most yearning to understand the actual physical real estate, how it operated. We were solving a math problem, and I was interested in the physical space that math problem represented. And so coming out of that was looking for opportunities to be in the sector, and was very honed and focused in my search. Very lucky to have found Walton Street, because in 2010, most private equity firms were not yet back to hiring. And I think, Walton Street the previous year hired zero people. They hired just a handful the year that I joined. And it was fortunate that, even 1 year away, I probably would have had a very different path.
For sure. And then I think both all of these roles in Bookley, everything obviously is your entrepreneurial journey, but all kinds of all of those lead us all the way up to starting Casa. So then in 2012, you go to KKR. What was the overview of your role there? Like, what size deals were you working on? What, type of assets were you working on there? And then how does that keep feeding up?
Yeah, I had an incredible time at Walton Street. Yeah. And it's a very entrepreneurial shop. I had much more responsibility than I felt I deserved, which allowed me to grow.
It's nice.
Grow really quickly. We were working on opening an office in Brazil. I worked with incredibly smart people. I was excited about building a business within a business in Brazil at Walton Street. It so happened that the Brazil economy, as we were opening the office, took a turn for the worse. And so the plans to open that office got put on pause. And at the same time, I still was excited about this entrepreneurial business within a business idea. And serendipitously, KKR was building within the large asset management firm a real estate business. And they had just started it. Ralph and team had just joined. I think they had five people who were the initial team members, and I joined as the six. And their thesis, which I fundamentally believed in, was that out of the GFC, there was an empty space for large asset managers that were left open by the fact that a lot of the asset management firms in the great financial crisis who were focused on real estate did not endure. And so there was an opening for a KKR, for a TPG, for others to build out their real estate presence. And alongside that thesis, they brought together an incredible team. And so I was excited about the idea of building a business within a business, joining as the sixth member, and both investing and built in real estate and building a real estate business alongside some of the people that I respect most to this day in the industry. So what I worked on was ran the gamut across underwriting, and we were a very small team. So looking at new deals, sometimes sourcing deals, looking at private public transactions, operating businesses across asset classes, even lightly involved in the fundraising for their fund, which was well in excess of what a typical associate in another fund, if it were much larger, would be doing. I ended up spending much more time in hospitality and multifamily because those are the areas that, one, we were had some focus in, and two, I had a lot of interest and excitement about hospitality, particularly because there's such a complexity, such an operational intensity, such a dynamism to the asset class, which means it's harder, but it also means it has more levers that you can pull to outperform, not just on the buy, on the financing, and on the sell, but really on the management of the properties.
Absolutely. obviously that fits in well with Jonathan said something similar, obviously, because he found your company to fall in line with that too. But just that there are more levers in these real estate operating businesses, whether it's hotel or something like you guys, than just buying an apartment at this cost, and you have fewer variables there. A unique move after KKR to have this like established very high pedigree career, then to go back to business school. So like, what was your thought process in, why did you want to go to Stanford? I think what, 2015?
Yeah.
What made that the right move to you in your mind as an entrepreneur? Like, where were you at?
So I had this love for technology, which is born out of really a love of building. Mm-hmm. Which also is why I love real estate, right? Is in the word building, right? Or build is in the word building. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that I could combine those two loves together, the love for technology and real estate. And in 2006, that seemed impossible. And in 2015, it increasingly was becoming obvious that just investing in real estate without differentiation in the same way as everyone else was no longer going to be acceptable, that there was going to be a survival of the fittest for investors that can find a unique edge. And often, not always, technology was becoming a source of that unique edge, and figuring out for myself how to marry the side of me that loves technology and the side of me that loves real estate was something I was really motivated to do. And I also recognized that, you know, there are lots of amazing people who are the best in the world at real estate investing. And there are also lots of amazing people in the world who are really great technologists. And there were very few people who overlapped and had a real rigorous education and experience in technology, and also a education and experience at the highest level in real estate. And that felt like the overlap of the Venn diagram of where I had a lot of passion, where I could create value, and where there was kind of a unique expertise. Stanford obviously has a tremendous reputation in the entrepreneurship and building and technology side, but it also was sort of a laboratory where I could experiment and think about ideas and how to bring those two parts of my passions and my expertise together.
So did you go with the idea that for many of us as entrepreneurs, right? Like you kind of know you want to set out and build a good business, but you don't know what it is, and you have to do everything you can until something clicks. Was going to Stanford kind of this idea that I'll go and hopefully I'll be able to figure something out that I want to do or build when you're there? Was that the idea in going, like, as an incubator for you to start a business?
It wasn't that I was set on building a business at Stanford. Okay. It was that I was set on figuring out how to bring together
the two. Okay.
And how that came to be, I was very open-minded. I looked at venture funds that were focused on the real estate technology sector. I spent a summer interning at Juniper Square, which is a technology-focused startup. At the time, it had 4 people. Now they've really ballooned and I think have a few hundred people and are much more well established in the in the sector, and also starting a business. So I looked at operating, starting a business, investing, really just trying to understand where I could add the most value and what was most interesting to me and what I thought would be most successful.
This episode of The Deal Ranch is brought to you by Reed's Jewelers. If you're looking for a new watch, Reed's has it. They have a large selection of fine Swiss timepieces from Omega, IWC, Breitling, Grand Seiko, Tudor, and Tag Heuer. Since 1946, Reed's has been devoted to customer service and quality. Find a Reed's store near you or shop online at reeds.com. That's REEDS.com by clicking the link in the show notes. So then what's the inception process of Casa? At what point in school do you kind of tangle with the idea? I heard in one of your other interviews, you said something like, when you were with KKR, you were underwriting and you were buying hospitality deals, but you were staying in Airbnbs on the road. So you kind of saw this disconnect there. Maybe you hosted one at your place. But what was the inception process of Casa, the idea? And then what were those first month or year? Like, how do you get it running?
Yeah, like any idea, I think there isn't a one moment where it sort of clicks. There's maybe it feels that way in retrospect. Yeah, exactly. The first time I heard about Airbnb, it felt like it was going, and that was sometime in 2010. I think I even applied or sent a letter to Brian Chesky about it. It felt like it was answering a cry for help from consumers, that the existing hospitality landscape just wasn't delivering on what many consumers wanted, whether it was location, price, space, digital enablement, something was missing, and Airbnb was the answer to the cry for help, but an imperfect one, because sometimes I'm sure you've stayed in many, and they can be amazing, and they can also be just one of your worst experiences. And for a lot of trips, you can't take that risk. And so it was truly a cry for help from consumers. And so I've been thinking about that idea ever since I heard about Airbnb. I actually, with a few friends, bought a property that we operated in Chicago as a furnished rental for a few years, and the yields on that property were strong. Me and my dad bought a property near us, and we were getting something like over 100% cash on cash yield in a town next to us. We didn't think that would scale, but the economics were quite good. What wasn't good is the ability to operate those properties was really difficult. Our ability to brand them was really difficult. I kept coming back to this idea, and also coming back to the fact that costs were rising in the hotel industry, whether it be labor costs, whether it be, you know, insurance, whether in today's market, it's, you know, debt service. Fixed costs at the asset have been going up, and were going up for some time. And then in the apartment world, more and more apartment buildings were being built with the aesthetic and feeling of a hospitality property. They had cabanas by the poolside, mm-hmm. and nice gyms, great amenities, scents in the lobby, everything you'd expect from a hospitality property. And yet, you know, somewhere on page 3 in your lease, it says you cannot Airbnb or sublet your unit. And yet every apartment has to be leased for a year unfurnished. And as the world becomes more flexible, and it was back then, it's accelerated since COVID, people want something different. They want to stay for a few days furnished. They want to stay for a week, for 2 weeks, for a month. They want a different type of place to stay in. Mm-hmm. They want a furnished rental perhaps. And the apartment communities, if done right, they are a great place for people to stay, and a great place for the owner to help monetize some of the amenities that they've built out to make it feel very hospitable, not just for the long-term renters, but also for the short, medium-term furnished renters. And so it's this confluence of an idea that had been building with some durable trends around cost structures increasing, people wanting a different approach to hospitality, the increase in flexibility that all came together to help create a confidence in starting Casa.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. So you have obviously the obvious problem to solve on the consumer side is a more reliable stay, a nicer stay, different areas, like they're countless. And then on the operator side, we can kind of talk about this in depth a little bit later, but there's a myriad of problems that you guys are solving, from fixing vacancy or, you know, decreasing vacancy for some folks. I saw there was like 5 or 10% of your folks that are booking are testing if they want to live there as an apartment lease, which is kind of unique too. And that never would have crossed my mind.
Yeah.
So it solves a myriad of problems. So as the entrepreneur, after you have these ideas and you see the trends and you want to get rolling, what was the path from kind of maybe getting the first mock-up of the logo or wherever you're initially like, hey, we're starting Casa, to the Prometheus deal? Like, how long to get that first deal?
Yeah. So things have been generally a steady build for us. That first deal, as is often the case, was the hardest. Yeah. I came in after I had got confidence and conviction that this was the right thing to build, thinking that it would be easy to convince the first owner to partner with us to operate a portion of their units in their building as furnished any length of stay rentals. Especially considering we were already doing it in a building that I owned with friends in Chicago, and one near my hometown in Boston.
And you probably have a lot of good relationships from KKR with large asset owners, I'm assuming.
That's right. Yeah, we had a Rolodex. So there was a one part of the early competitive advantage was we can just call a few folks that I had worked with, built trust with before, and see if they have vacant units.
Right.
It turned out, you know, that it was harder to get those first units than we expected by an order of magnitude. It required, I remember, you know, everyone wanted proof, right? They trusted me, but they didn't know if we could do it because there wasn't an organization behind us at the time. And so it required, you know, we cold called, we knocked on apartment building doors, lots of cold emails. I remember, I think we got the first, bite with Prometheus on my birthday in 2016 in August, cool. Which was I was working on the birthday, but it was probably the best birthday that I had had. And it was the founder of Prometheus, Jackie, she really understood the vision for what we were building. Their properties are phenomenal properties in the Bay Area. And what we were doing, the aesthetic, the kind of clientele we were bringing in, really fit and complemented those buildings really well. And so we got the first deal, in quotes, was four units that we signed with Prometheus in August 2016 and had to scramble within, you know, a few days to get them furnished and rented, which was a Herculean and effort involving sleeping on the floor of the apartment units to get them furnished, getting, you know, a lot to happen that now, you know, should have taken a month in 3 days, but it was, wow. it was adrenaline inducing and exciting.
That's awesome. What was the success of those units financially for Prometheus at the end of the day? Like, so obviously you ink the first deal, that's step one, but executing to your partners, obviously step two. So how did that turn out to them? And after you kind of sync back up or see kind of the results financially for them, did that allow you to get Guy 2 or Gal 2 to do the next deal? Like, how do you start building over time to, I guess we can kind of bridge it to modern date now if you...
Yeah. So the what they saw is very similar to the value proposition today. So this, our first property was in Santa Clara. It was a new development in lease up. During lease up, the units that they gave to us were not going to the absorption schedule, you know, saw those units getting leased up in 24 months roughly. And instead of, you know, being leased up in 24 months, they were leased up on month zero, or they were starting to generate revenue for Prometheus in month zero. And the value as an apartment developer today, or an apartment owner today, if or a potential buyer today, is very similar. If you're buying an apartment building and the property is not yet fully constructed, mm-hmm. you're able to start operating them furnished rentals on day zero, start making cash flow on those units as they are, the other units are leasing up. And then at the completion of the lease up, you're making more cash flow running them furnished any length of stay because nightly rents are greater for short stay versus what people lease up on a net basis after expenses. And so you're generating a premium to your NOI. So that, and quite a significant one. That is what Prometheus saw. After that first deal, the next month they asked us, hey, can you expand to another property? Actually two additional properties. I was still at Stanford, so we now had a small hotel business that we were running, but we're still building the infrastructure. So often when we were helping to check in guests, calls would come to my phone. I was in class, I'd leave class to try to help guests in whatever way they needed. I think I joke about this, but I think it's true that my class thought I had a bladder issue, just the frequency of time.
Bathroom trips.
Yeah.
Very funny. So in kind of bringing it to more modern date here, one of the big things that I've always been curious about, like in doing my research and prep for this and listening to you on other shows, is like, how do you continue, like, what is the team focused on now as far as scalability? Because it obviously provides great results for the operator and then the end user, right? Like, that's very, very simple and obvious. But as far as how do you guys do business development now and how can you scale? Because I'm assuming, like, zoning is probably a complexity to it and working with operators that are maybe a little bit more old-fashioned, although you can drive a higher NOI for their property, they may not want to take the risk. Or maybe there's even, is there lender red tape with like people that have these big loans on large multifamily assets? Are they not allowed to short-term rent? But how do you continue to scale right now? Or like, where do you focus on growing? You're at 1 million plus nights already in 45 or so cities. What is your focal point for growing, and kind of where are you allowed to grow with zoning, or how do you view business development, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Something we think about a lot, and it's dynamic. There are some principles that we hold constant, and then there are the application of those principles that change as the, you know, game on the field adjusts. At the very highest level, there are three form factors, as I mentioned, in which we deploy our engine, which that engine, you know, improves the profitability of hospitality: apartments, hotels, and single family homes. The reality is the application of our engine, the operations and technology that we use to operate these properties, is very similar across these. So to us, from a company perspective, outside of the brand implications, we are somewhat ambivalent as to whether we are growing in apartments or in hotels or in single family homes. But what's valuable to us about the ability to flex across those three is, in any given time, one of those is in greater focus or need than another. And that changes depending on the real estate cycle. So it creates a lot more stability for the operating business. And it also allows us to not be a one-trick pony in terms of how we are growing. So for a period of time, for example, in COVID, 2021 through 2022, apartment rents went up quite a bit and occupancies went up quite a bit. And as a result, it wasn't very useful for owners to have us in their apartment buildings, because they could close their eyes, do nothing, and see 20% increases
right.
in NOI yeah. growth. And that meant we would have struggled mightily to grow in apartments. But at the same time, hotel cost structures were getting crushed. And as a result, we saw tremendous demand from hotel owners to implement the same technology, the same operations to help their properties become more profitable. So the ability to switch off across the three is a fundamental advantage. In terms of how we decide where to deploy, we at the end of the day are a trusted partner to owners. We are looking to deliver to them more income. And we're also looking to do that over a long time horizon and be their trusted partner over a long time horizon. It isn't easy to earn the trust of the organizations I mentioned, like Starwood and Cortland and Greystar and others. And so we're focused on the question, can we deliver a better result to your property than you could do without us? And if we can't, we'll point the owner in a different direction or suggest we aren't the right fit for the property. It's much worse for us to suggest that we are a fit and then not do a great job than to do otherwise. But then realizing that we're focused on being a trusted partner and problem solver for owners, we look to where owners at any given time have the most problems. So problems are, you know, my property isn't making enough cash flow. My apartment building isn't leasing up fast enough. Where does our system of operating hospitality solve that problem most effectively? Today, we're seeing that hotel owners are struggling with insurance, taxes, debt service, and cost of labor increases across a number of big cities like LA, New York, San Francisco, Miami, et cetera. And we're seeing apartment owners in the Sun Belt, especially, but across the US, are seeing a wall of new supply with a reset cost of debt, perhaps expiring caps in some cases, and a weaker multifamily set of fundamentals in terms of rent growth, occupancy, and ultimately, because of rising costs in apartments, NOI growth. And that's in those two sectors, we can be a problem solver and solutions provider. And then we look at the individual building and understand whether that property will work under from a zoning perspective, from a lender perspective, from kind of a business plan perspective for the owner. So there's a top layer of where should we spend our time? Where are there the most problems that fit the kind of hospitality we deliver and we can solve? And then within that, once we know we should focus on Sunbelt markets and multifamily or high cost markets and hospitality, we look at the individual asset and understand the zoning, understand the capital structure, understand the business plan, and then advise on how we can help the owner deliver on their hoped for results.
Wow. You touched on all three of your different asset classes there, single family, hospitality, and then multifamily as well. And we chatted before about the opportunity, I think, in this market for you, especially multifamily, but you actually alluded to really all three there. So what would be the best overview of your multifamily offering? Like, I had a couple questions about just like the structure of it, because you have this revenue share agreement, which anyone that's an operator can access on the website through your investor deck. But how does that deal structure work? How long are the agreements? How does it work if that asset owner wants to sell the property? Are you guys still in place? I know you said management agreement, but like, how essentially does that work? Can you break that down to me just for multifamily, and then we can do the other two as well? Overview.
Absolutely. Yeah. So everything starts with how much value are we delivering to the building. Yep. So it starts with an underwriting. Are we able to generate more money to the NOI during lease up and then at stabilization relative to the owner's alternative? And then there's a question of how do you split the risk and the profit from that operation? Some operators split the risk by leasing properties. Other operators have focused, like ourselves, on management agreements and revenue shares. The most simple approach is a management agreement that looks very close to a hotel management agreement.
Okay,
we take a percentage of the top line with maybe an incentive on bottom line, and how that split depends on the specifics of the opportunity. The top line fee helps pay for our G&A. The bottom line fee helps us to earn an incentive based on the hard work we're doing to outperform, and hopefully aligns incentives with the owner in doing so. And then the expenses are reimbursed by the owner. The upfront cost of the furniture is borne by the deal in some way, typically by the owner. There needs to be they are looking at a payback period on the furniture and a return on the furniture, so that we help them to understand. There can be some creativity in how we structure the payment of the furniture. Obviously, you need to furnish the apartment units to rent them out any length of stay. In terms of the term of those agreements, our apartment units are typically on a 3 to 5 year term, but we do give owners a right to terminate on sale. And there's performance tests in our agreements. So, you know, from my perspective, we want to be a trusted partner and deliver results to owners. If we're not delivering results, A, we're not earning our incentive fee, and B, the owner has the right to terminate us, and C, our business is predicated on building those trusted relationships over a very long period of time. And so that's, entering into agreements like that is something we try to avoid, where we don't think we'll be successful. But that's the typical structure. We do have some variants on that management agreement structure that help solve for specific needs the owner might have, either from their lender or from the fact that the property is owned in a REIT. There's a revenue share version in which we pay for our expenses ourselves, but take a much higher fee. We prefer the management agreement, and I think most owners do as well. But if it's not possible, that's an approach that is. And then there's a waterfall lease structure in which money flows first to us to pay for our expenses, then to the owner until a certain threshold, then we split it. And that structure can work for certain owners who have capital structure or loan requirements. What we don't do are master leases. They don't help the owner in the long term, and they're toxic for the operating company as well, as is shown by a battlefield of companies that look like us but took a different approach the business model, and as a result, maybe as one of the inputs into the result, they didn't make it through a very difficult time in the last few years.
Interesting. What's the best fit if you're looking at a deal? Like, what is the, and maybe there's no right answer to this, but what's the best like multifamily asset tip? Like, and you could maybe give a range, but like typical asset size, how many units, maybe what class, kind of what age, may go hand in hand too, but you don't have to give rent range, but also what percentage of that asset do you think CASA performs the best of total units, like 5 to 20%? Like, what do you think is a good fit for you guys as a product?
Yeah. So we typically look for class A and as low as class B plus properties. Okay. We've partnered with urban high rises, mid rises, and even some garden style properties. And we've partnered in cities like Nashville and Chicago. In Chicago, we're actually proud in a few cities to be the number one ranked property on TripAdvisor.
That's so cool.
It's very gratifying. Yeah. To see that that's the case in Seattle, number one in Seattle and Chicago, and I think Denver, and top five in San Francisco and Pittsburgh. I realize it's a bit, it's like being proud of your children. So I have to say it, but I imagine people roll their eyes. But it's okay. We take the delivery of the service really, really seriously. So we're in some cities like Nashville and Chicago and Miami, but we're also in more suburban locations like Wellington, Florida, and many others, and both locations do quite well for us. Some cities do worse and some suburbs do worse. So it's really a location specific underwriting. The principle that informs whether we'll do well is there a lot of travel demand? Is there leisure demand into the city? Is there demand maybe from a hospital system? Is there demand maybe from a government center? So maybe it's the Houston Medical Center that the property is next to, or you're next to, Sacramento, seat of government for California, or it's the leisure demand that exists in Austin or Chicago or Miami. In Wellington, it's polo season in the winter. And so the question is there demand? And what is that demand on a relative basis for short stay versus for long stay? And how much new supply is coming online for apartments versus how much new supply is coming online for hotels. So the markets that do the best have the most demand for short stay furnished. They have maybe tempering demand for apartments. They have a lot of new apartment supply coming online, and they have not as much on a relative basis relative to percentage of inventory of hotel supply coming online. And that configuration sets up for a very, very, very good product for us.
Wow. What I think one good thing to highlight here too, as far as your average length of stay, and then if you want to also, because a lot of people at first glance, they may think you're a competitor to Airbnb, right? But you have a good partnership because your product's offered on the platform.
That's right.
Maybe a good thing to highlight. But what is your average stay compared to the hotel stay? Because that, when I'm going through your reports, that was fascinating to me. And just you have this product that meets a lot of different demands, but if you want to kind of cover those two things, it's interesting.
Yeah, so I'll start with the second. We are proud partners with That's Airbnb, right. And we're partnered with a lot of distribution channels in addition to Airbnb as well. Ultimately, our goal is to deliver the most profitability to our partners, and we want to make sure the properties that we are operating are in the most stores. If you're in more stores, you'll sell more inventory, right? And especially when inventory is perishable, if we don't sell a room tonight, it generates $0 and disappears. You want to make sure that you are well merchandised and well distributed. And so we're in over 45 channels, including Airbnb, Expedia, Booking.com. We're in the global distribution system and the travel management companies like Amex Global Business Travel, like Navan. We're on the medium-term stay channels for medium-term leasing like Zillow and Furnish Finder and many others. We're on Google and TripAdvisor, et cetera. So we're really well, and Airbnb, we're a super host on Airbnb. We have direct integration with them and we bring them high quality supply. They bring us high quality demand. So it's a partnership we're very proud to continue to grow. On the length of stay side and type of guest side. So there's two frames, right? One are median and average length of stay is roughly 6 nights. So much longer than a typical hotel stay, which is about 1 to 2 nights. That's on the apartment side of our product. Okay. The general rule is the larger the unit, the longer the stay. Think families are staying with us for a week or two, people on longer term business trips, people who are living on the road for a little while. So people who are taking an extra day on a weekend after a work trip to stay in Austin or Chicago or somewhere else. So those folks are staying for 5-7 nights. We also have a contingent of folks who are staying 30 plus nights as well. What we care about in our, especially in our apartment communities, is that the people who stay with us are trusted travelers that are vetted in the same way that the long-term residents are vetted in the community. So you mentioned trust and safety earlier.
Yeah.
And it's very important for us. It's very important for the neighbors that live in the communities. And it's very important for our owners that we are additive to the community rather than rather than a disruption. And that's one of the reasons why when I started the business, many owners were banning Airbnb from their buildings. They were worried that they'd bring in folks who are throwing parties, they worried about trashed units, they worried about issues around trust and safety. And you never want 5 to 10% of your building to have a negative effect on the long-term residents of your building. And so the first thing we built in the business is what is regarded as kind of the strongest trust and safety infrastructure to reduce incident rates at the properties. And it starts with a background check that we run on everyone who stays with us that is identical to the one that's run on the long-term residents. We ask everyone to upload their ID and a selfie. They move their face from side to side for their selfie so that we know it's not a Facebook image. We compare the two. Cool. We check the ID for if it's real. We then have decibel meters and marijuana sensors in every unit. And we have a predictive AI-based risk score, which tells us the likelihood a stay or a booking will have an issue. It looks at things around your stay, like are you traveling within 30 miles of the property or traveling around your birthday? Are you maxing out occupancy with different last names? We look at 70 reservation details that we have shown over time correlate with a likelihood of a bad stay. A bad stay defined as, you know, a noise disturbance or some kind of incident at the property. And right now we benchmark our data against publicly reported data from Airbnb. We reduce incident rates by about 87 to 90% relative to the incident rates reported by Airbnb by the proactive features that we use to prevent bad stays. But then if there is an incident, we know about it because of the decibel meters, the marijuana sensors in the units. I spent a lot of time talking about this because it's super important to not just our owners and our neighbors, but other guests, ensuring that when you're in a community, an apartment community, that you feel safe when it's a personless, arrival experience is really crucial in hotels and in apartments and in homes. And, we've really spent a significant amount of time delivering on that promise to our owners and guests and neighbors.
Yeah. It's amazing. One last question for you. Kind of more on the operation side, then I want to get to the service side, because what you guys do is really incredible, and we chatted a little bit about it before. But the what is the onboarding process for new property? The timeline in one of the decks showed like 20 days, which seems remarkably quick from signing a deal like to furnishing it and getting it all. Like, what is your process? What is the onboarding process of a new deal or a property to going live? Because I'm sure that transition time is obviously very important to the operator, because you're upfitting the unit or buying, right? Getting it ready to produce income. What is the time frame roughly, and like how are you guys able to be so nimble and do it so quickly?
Yeah, so I always say that right is more important than fast, but fast is also important. And we have a few advantages over a traditional hospitality operator in terms of our ability to move quickly, largely because we've either eliminated, automated, or centralized a lot of the systems that are at the property. So, you know, we don't have as much staff need at the property, which can be a longer lead time item, training need at the property. A lot of that infrastructure and delivery is central to CASA, and then every additional property just plugs into our operating infrastructure, and that gives us a speed advantage. We don't have a speed advantage if there's heavy renovation needed, if there's, you know, something very physical that's required at the property. But in most instances where we're just installing furniture, which is our standard package, we have warehouses and kind of logistics providers that can help to make that very efficient. And we have a launch team that has done this, you know, 75 times across the plus times across the US. We can do the standard CASA. We can build the standard CASA very quickly. The standard CASA might be an apartment building where we're doing a few floors up to 100%. So 5 to 100% of the building. We either see owners go to 5 to 20% or really a much higher percentage. There's rarely a situation where they're like, I want 35%. It's either 50% or 100 after that first 20. But if that the work that needs to happen there is for us to, you know, install the furniture and then hire the housekeepers, which we often in market already have if we're in the market we're already in, or if we're not, we have a fairly honed process to add additional housekeepers, add someone local, either GM or if we don't have one already in the market, or someone who can help us with maintenance, and then bring the properties live onto our distribution channel. So we have a very kind of honed checklist and playbook to get those live. For the hotel properties, there's also a component of relaunching the property with either a different name or the and also transporting kind of reservations from the previous operator to us.
Interesting.
But again, all of these things are measured typically in weeks, not in months. That being said, if we need to do a real repositioning of the asset, that would of course take quite a long. Yeah.
Interesting. Transitioning the last couple kind of service or customer facing questions for the business, and then we can cover a deal and wrap up. You guys have been doing this since 2016. And when I was poking around on the site, like you go through the, like you, people think of Airbnb and it obviously well established, you know, the for shorter term stay and kind of in some juxtaposition similar to a product you guys offer. And we already covered that, but it makes sense why their platform's so built out. But when you click through on your answers, I like kind of poked around like I was going to stay. You go through the FAQs. It's wildly detailed and built out. Like every question's answered there. How long does that take to develop for you guys? And especially being a relatively newer company. And then if you want to cover the core values we were talking about earlier, I think are pretty unique. We didn't get a chance to chat on. But like, what is the process to refining this customer facing part of the business? And then obviously you're hammering and building out the operational side or asset side of the business too, which is interesting. Like how do you build that out so well?
Yeah. So we've learned as we went around what we need to build out in order to deliver a great stay to the guest at a reasonable cost to the owner, and do so better and better over time. You know, when you're staying with CASA, it's a delightfully unique experience from the start. You are checking in on, you kind of done the check-in after you booked the property. You upload your ID and your selfie and you're done. You don't have to go to a front desk when you arrive. You get a unique code via text, and you also have access to a virtual front desk, which gives you step-by-step instructions with a picture paired with text that show you how to get from your Uber or your car to the inside of your CASA in under 5 minutes. You're, you know, typing in a code on the exterior of the building. You have directions, take the elevator, you go to their unit, and you're inside. If you have questions, you text us on the same number that gave you the instructions, or you call us. We're 24/7. And when you text us, you expect a fast answer, you expect an accurate answer, you expect hospitality in the way that we deliver an answer. And sometimes we need to do something in person. If you're staying with us, you know, you're asking for extra pillows, we need to bring you extra pillows. And we need to do it quickly. And so we need to do all that with cost in mind. What we realized is many questions that we were answering offsite. So a lot of our customer service team, we call it guest experience team, for to kind of to embody the spirit of hospitality. They need to be very quick and able to pull up information about the property while offsite, so that they can give you ask about how the thermostat works. They can look that up really quickly and answer very accurately. And so what we've done as one of the ways we've worked to be able to deliver on that need quickly is we've digitized the physical space. So we have, whenever we launch a property, we kind of look at every element of the unit. We look at the square footage. We look at the type of thermostat is there. We look at the views of the property, and we take what is unstructured data. Unstructured data just means it kind of doesn't have a category. Yep. And an ability to put it in a database very easily. And we structure it. We put it in a category. We make it easily searchable. We make it by our team. We make it such that our automated systems can utilize that information, so that when you're staying and you ask about extra pillows, we know to route that to the on-site team. And that on-site team then gives you the extra pillows quickly. We know that if you're asking about the thermostat, our central team can answer that also very quickly and accurately. And when you're staying, the experience for you needs to be completely divorced from the fact that we have all this technology and infrastructure delivering the experience. It needs to just feel magical. It needs to feel like, wow, when I needed something, I got it. And otherwise, they stayed out of my hair. And there's this feeling of hospitality without anyone being overbearing or like watching me as I walk into the property. And I think that's the magic that we aim to deliver. And that's why you saw on our website, as one of the kind of above the water level of the iceberg, one of the signs that we do this is the FAQs and the detail around the property. But there's a lot more beneath the surface that helps to power that experience for the guests. And to your point, you asked about our values. Our values help. We have four company values there: Hall of Fame host, fearless feedback. We laugh about one called feed two birds with one scone.
Which it's is the idea. Very funny.
It's funny. We thought we don't take ourselves
too
seriously.
Who thought of that? You?
I think I.
Or is that out there? I've never heard that until I read it. Feed two birds with one scone.
It's the idea of resourceless. I think all of our values came from introspection as an organization about who we are and what we want to become. They inform. The values need to be unique to us. Of course, we need to follow things that every company to be successful follows, like be high integrity, build trust, et cetera. There are a few things that are unique to us that how we behave informs is that a few values that are, that inform how we behave, and that those behaviors are specific to our business model. And the likelihood of success of that business model. And so the values, they help us attract specific people. They help tell us who we should promote, who we should reward with, you know, extra compensation, who we should part ways with, and they interact with how we do things. So feed two birds, one scone. Yeah, it is funny, but the resourcefulness element fits with our focus on lowering the cost structure of operating hospitality. And an example, when we interview someone and they for an on-site position, and we ask them, how can you have $5 or $10 to make this stay better? How do you make this better? And the person who realizes they can rearrange the lobby for free and make the flow of traffic easier, or add a sign that costs nothing to fix a check-in problem, or pick up some debris that's in the elevator and actually costs $0. Those people live that ethos, because some touches are, you can do without much expense. Some touches cost a lot of money, and then you can do a lot of some creative things with less. And that's the owner's mindset that our owners certainly have. And if we are to be their trusted partners, we need to have that is informs Feed Two Birds with One Scone. It also informs a similar type of reasoning informs our other values like seek the root cause,
yep.
Fearless feedback, et cetera. It's what is unique to our business. How do we hire, fire, promote, and how does it help our business model be more likely to succeed over the long run?
I love it. I think we've covered quite a bit, I think, on the operation side and then the service side too, the customer's facing product. Is there one deal story? I know we were chatting before, you think that stands out to you maybe as a significant acquisition or partnership? Is there any deal that you wanted to kind of highlight as is significant in the journey of Casa?
You know, there's one that I think the freshest deal might be the most interesting. So I don't know if this is the seminal deal that over the history of the company, but it is certainly one we're working on right now.
Cool.
And so I won't be able to be specific to the name to protect the innocent of the of the property, but we're working actively to transition a full service hotel in downtown LA from one manager to another. This is a 200 room property with a rooftop wraparound pool and F&B area with a 1600 room theater and a lobby, bar, and restaurant. And it's a quite an iconic property in downtown LA. And the I think the setup of this property is probably one that many of your listeners who are either investors in hotels or owners of hotels are probably experiencing. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a pretty good operator that just was having trouble with the rise of costs in operating these a property like it in downtown LA. Also, downtown LA has, I think it will see a renaissance, but it has seen better days. And so we're excited to be working with ownership to transition that property to our operation, which will fundamentally improve the cost structure of the property. And we think will also improve the revenue production. This has been, you know, a 6 months in the making to get to this point. We're going to transition the property in about a month. So perhaps by the time this is live, I'm not sure it will be transitioned. And we, you know, in to get that deal set up, the owner was trying to figure out to solve a problem, just like all of our owners are, right? They had rising costs of debt service. They had rising insurance and taxes, rising cost of labor, basically the setup of many of these properties. And some of these were intractable and some of them are intractable unless you can change the way you operate the property and do it differently. They were initially considering a lease, but we, one, there are fewer and fewer operators who are offering leases in this market. And two, we were able to show that their downside protection was stronger with a management agreement. We gave them some flexibility. So if it's not working out, they always have the alternative of the other approach. They got more upside in this situation. And most importantly, they have much more control over how the operation will work. And because we are truly partnering with them in delivering this a reimagined property. They're keeping the brand. It won't be branded Casa. It will be powered by Casa. So our infrastructure will help bring the property to life. And the amount of increase in NOI that we will deliver is like, or GOP margin, a gross operating profit margin, which is the area of the P&L up to which we control, is dramatic. It's something like well over 2x the previous operator. And if you capitalize the amount of improvement to NOI that should drive, it's somewhere in the $150,000 per key to $250,000 per key increase if you take the NOI that we are improving their performance by and capitalize it. And that's obviously quite significant because all they're doing is changing managers at that property. But I think there will be more and more situations like it. We did find a great third-party F&B operator for the restaurant and for the theater and lobby area. And so we will do what we do best in the world, and the F&B operator will operate the F&B to get married together. We'll deliver a holistic and unified experience to the guest and a much improved P&L to the owner.
Sounds like a pretty strong deal.
We're excited about it. A lot of work ahead. We're getting to day zero on it.
What? How did they find you guys? Like, how did they? What was the origin of the deal? How'd you source it? Was it business development team proactive, or just kind of the fruits of the labor of doing good work for, you know, a long time now, and them hearing about you guys, how did it come together?
It's a combination of all of those.
Yeah.
In this case, I think this conversation started through an inbound through one of our investors, where they had learned that the owner was looking to looking more broadly at ways to deploy capital and alternative accommodations into the furnished rental space, but also owned hotels, and were seeking ways to improve their operations. And like any relationship, we built trust over a longer period of time, and we're just continuing to do that. We know day zero is when we start operating, and we'll have to, you know, to work very hard to deliver on the results of the ownership.
Wow, that's a great deal. In wrapping up here a little bit, a couple last questions for you. So we talked about everything, obvious, I think, operations related, but we did single family is a little bit newer to you guys, but is there any, like, what is the focus of the company moving forward? You have this big deal, which is nice, that's coming online in a month or so. And then single family is a relatively newer product, so to speak, for you guys. But at the end of last year, maybe, I think you got a huge partnership, AMLI, right? Like you're their premier short-term or their number one partner, so you guys have a ton going on. Like what's the big focus for you moving forward in this market?
Yeah. So we're always going to solve the problems that our owners have, that are most pressing to our owners, where what we can do fits nicely to solve those problems. And in any market, that problem will be different, right? Meaning we kind of have a superpower we can trade off across these different asset types, single family homes, hotels, apartments. In any given market, the set of problems will be most acute in one of those, or maybe two of those, unlikely all three. Mm-hmm. And so today, and in the last 2 years, we saw the most need in the hotel world, where apartments were doing quite well with 20% increase in NOI and huge rent increases and occupancy increases. We're seeing that fundamental, the fundamentals there slow down significantly. And we're seeing owners increasingly poke their head up above ground who previously were saying, we're good, we have no need for improved occupancy, we have no need for reduced vacancy, and saying, we're looking to find a different approach to making our properties as profitable as possible, especially the development folks. So I expect that will be a large driver over the next 24 months, as hotels will continue to be strong, but they have been just very strong for the last year or two. Single family homes, I think we view it as inevitable that the single family home space professionalizes and that brands emerge in terms of vacation rental offerings to guests. And the reason we view it as inevitable is consumers want a more reliable, trustworthy experience, a branded experience. Branded, and there just isn't one. And that's, if you look at the history of the hotel space, the emergence of Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt started after initially there was a fragmentation of more mom and pop owners and operators who were delivering a similar experience, but weren't able to guarantee a reliability and a quality. And that's the problem that Marriott solved. There is a similar need in single family vacation rentals. The issue right now in that space is that mortgage payments have gone up and insurance has gone up in many markets, but revenues haven't gone up to the same degree and prices haven't gone up. And in some markets, revenues, which were very strong during COVID times, have tempered a bit. And so while that is a strong long-term growth path and we're very excited about it, in the near term, we're watching to see how the market stabilizes and ensuring that we're deploying our resources into the markets that are the strongest. That's not to say we'll be, you know, not doing anything in single family homes. It's to say that we expect it to be slower on a relative basis to hotels, which is the most potent right now, and apartments, which is growing in momentum.
Wow. That'll be exciting to see what you guys do with single family as it expands over time. Similar question, but just give you an open door here to comment on anything if we missed it. But is there any service, market, or asset class that you guys haven't been in outside of these three that maybe in the future you would want to experiment with in any way? Is there anything else in your mind that you guys haven't done yet that you see as an opportunity moving forward or that fascinates you maybe?
We're excited about partnering with real estate investors to give them a competitive edge on the buying motion of a property. And so some call it PropCo, OpCo, you know, some call it by a different name. But at the end of the day, we deliver more profit into these properties, and we have a tremendous amount of data across our ecosystem to understand where that delivery is strongest. We can help an acquisition professional weaponize that information and gain a real edge by having a different business plan than the 10 other bidders on an asset. And so I'm excited by Forcasa. That helps us to control the inventory that we partner on and program it to be to reflect the feedback that we receive from guests and to deliver the best possible experience and you know, consequently a high ROI to owners, which we can't always do when we don't partner on the buy of a property. It's sort of existing buildings that have a existing physical footprint that the owner is not as willing to change. Mm-hmm. And so we're excited for Casa to control inventory more effectively and to be able to program the properties to deliver the most in results for owners and to guests, where it also just makes sense for the acquisition professionals. I would have killed as a acquisition person at KKR or Walton Street to have an arrow in my quiver that gave me access to more income, differentiated data and underwriting, and differentiated ability to deliver on the results relative to other buyers. And so we don't have, you know, we don't have capacity to work with multiple folks, but we're excited to work with a select few to find the right assets, whether it's hotels, apartments, or single family homes, where we can deliver a real advantage. So I'm really quite excited about that. Much more long term, I'm excited about the fully flexible building. I think that's the way the world is going. We'll wake up one day in 10 years or at some point between now and then, and you'll have a building in which some portion is unfurnished long term, some portion is furnished short term, some is resident hosting, where in the long term unit, you're renting out your unit while you're traveling, and Casa is helping to operate that inventory while you are traveling. And then there's the set of travelers, a small percentage, who want to live on the road all the time. And they want maybe to have a principal home. Maybe they have their apartment unit in Chicago that we're renting out for them as they're traveling. But they're often staying in different parts of the Casa ecosystem. Maybe they go to New York one weekend, another weekend to Miami, hopefully, you know, beyond there as well. And because we're renting out their unit while they're traveling, they're paying once. And they're staying anywhere. And that, I think, is where the world is ultimately going. For the owner, it means the building is more flexible, is lower risk, it has more profit potential. For the resident, there's a lot more ways to deliver on their needs for flexibility.
Wow. It would almost be creating within a building a completely efficient market where the moment you step out, it generates income. That's kind of wild to think.
That's right.
The last question for you. In your career, obviously, you've worked with a lot of great companies. You've accomplished a lot of great things in building this platform. Who do you think to you has served as a great mentor? Or are there a handful of people that you've learned a lot from? Like who helped you the most, do you think, throughout your career?
Yeah, no, I think there's three things come to mind.
Okay.
One, there's no greater inflection point in my career than what I said earlier, which is the coming to the United States. That's just a fundamental shift. So my family has been a huge source of both luck and you know, feeling of responsibility to give back on the risk they took. Maybe a less orthodox, but also very important for me, is reading about others who have built things in the past. I'm a voracious consumer of how did Conrad Hilton build his business. You know, I'm currently reading about the same for the Marriott family. But those are kind of the mainstream folks. But even just, you know, standing on or sitting on the shoulder of Phil Knight and Shoe Dog, and the many stories of people who have built great things and the difficulties along the way that you can borrow from, I think is underestimated. I will make many mistakes and have made many mistakes in building Casa, but if I can borrow from folks who've built great business in the past and avoid a few that they have made and learn from the way that they approached their business and succeeded, that's really a huge benefit. And lastly, I'm very grateful for the team at KKR for taking a risk on me when they were just building their business. And then, you know, Billy Butcher and Ralph Rosenberg, you know, they both were advocates for me to go to Stanford as alums themselves. And I think that whole team is a really phenomenal one. And similarly, there's been a handful of folks at Walton Street, including folks who are at Casa, Jordan Calagiri, who was a mentor and now a colleague at Casa, who have been phenomenal partners in helping build the business and help me grow in my career.
I love it. I think that's a good place to wrap up. Is there anything else Casa related or anything you would want to steer any listener to?
No, this is really comprehensive. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. And obviously anyone listening, go to Casa.com and stay with Casa.
With a K.
That's right.
I love it.